as I mentioned last week, I think I didn't actually choose the title of this talk. This is an inspiration of Ajahn Sumedho, and he mentioned it to me. That, my first thought was, of course, he must be joking. But then I realized that he wasn't, and also that that in a way, even though some of the terminology in the title is a little bit daunting, actually the area of is very generally very interesting to people in the West trying to figure out a way of understanding and an approach to the workings of life. So anyway, I thought I might as well begin by talking a little bit about the terminology. And so what the title of the talk is Buddhism, Metaphysics and Eschatology, which I was more tempted to actually just talk about metaphysics and escapology. But... But then as I started to sort of ponder the subject and look up a few things and think about it, I realized, well, it's pretty much the same. It's kind of Buddhist escapology. It's really what the whole thing is about. So metaphysics can mean a whole variety of different things. But in this context of what I thought I'd talk about today, I take it to mean... that which is beyond the normal sense perception, human sense perception. So that which is outside of our perceptual realm. Actually, a couple of weeks ago, when I was in, I went to do a wedding blessing in Oxford, and someone, the person who was getting married, was telling me about this. A famous exchange that took place on one of the streets in Oxford, where an American tourist came up to this professorial type walking down the street and said to him, "Can you tell me where the university is?" And he looked at her with a complete authority, said, "Madam, the university is not anywhere. The university has only metaphysical rather than actual existence." What he meant was, it's spread out all over the town. And there isn't actually a place where the university is. So when we talk about metaphysics, it means, you know, that which is not perceptible, things which are not perceptible. Eschatology, I discovered. I freely confess I hadn't got a clue what the word meant, other than it was one of those long words that you come across in books about religion. And it literally means, eschatos is the Greek word for last or final. And logos means word, so it means, or the ology means like the study of the finality or the ending of things. So eschatology means the study of death, the afterlife, heaven and hell, judgment, those kind of things. So I can see that the number of people here today is approximately... a half or a third that they were here last week for Buddhism and psychology. So I think a substantial amount of trepidation has come over people just at the look of the thing. So this is a frightening subject, I understand, and also it has all the makings of being incredibly boring and theoretical, which is why I brought this stack of books along with me. But anyway... it's there's a lot to the subject, and particularly in the modern times, and also the process of importing an Asian religious tradition into the West, and in these times where there's a lot of a much more sort of mechanistic or conceptually based understanding of life. The ideas of heaven and hell, judgment, the afterlife, you know, the final day, Armageddon and so forth is pretty much out of fashion. You know, we don't like that sort of thing. You know, generally speaking, it's poo-pooed in all sort of serious religious spheres. No one in their right mind talks about heaven and hell these days. So here I am. But I think it's important to see that it's like within the, first of all, within the context of say the Western academic or philosophical approach, the axiom is that the human mind is unable to discover, has no means of discovering that which is beyond the realms of the senses, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, thinking mind. That's the sort of the basic premise on which our worldview is based, and reason, kind of a reasonable worldview, is based on that idea. And also very much more within the Asian perspective today, that's come in a lot more. People like Ajahn Buddhadasa have tried to present the Buddha's teachings also in a way free from the all of the gods and demons and heaven and hell and so on and so forth, to present a very clear, pragmatic teaching that's useful for the here and now, rather than focusing so much on a realm or worlds that we cannot see with our eyes. So, at least what I was brought up on a lot within my Buddhist education, if you like, and also being here in the West and talking with people a lot, is that when we see in the scriptures discussions of heaven and hell, or references to the five or sometimes the six realms of existence, that is, the human realm, the animal realm, the realm of hungry ghosts, the realm of hell beings, the realm of devatas or the celestial realms, and then the sixth one that's sometimes included is the realm of asuras, or the what are called the jealous gods. These are like powerful beings, but they're full of aggression. So they're like aggressive angels. You know, you see them on Harley Davidson's. So they're powerful beings, but they have a lot of anger and aggression that they mete out on the people around them. Particularly the devas, they can't stand those simpering devatas, the angels who kind of float around on lotus blossoms and are irritatingly happy all the time. So they like to smash them. So that they sometimes appear in the list, sometimes not. So anyway, my experience and sort of training in the Buddhist world always like to talk about these as psychological states. Like being reborn in heaven means being happy. If something happens, you meet with success or pleasure or affirmation or a delicious taste or a beautiful sound, then we are, by absorbing into that experience, then we are, quote, reborn in heaven. And then when something comes along to disturb that or take that away from us, when the when you come across the piece of broken glass inside the strawberry cheesecake, or someone comes along and bashes into your tape recorder and knocks it over just as you're just flying off in ecstasy at some Bach chorale or whatever, then joy and bliss turns into anger. You're reborn in hell, angry, fiery state. And that the transmigration, if you like, from one state to another was regarded very much in terms of psychological states. Moving from, craving, sense, the endless craving of the hungry ghost realm, kind of coarseness and instinctuality of the animal realm. These are just reflecting different states of mind that all of us experience during the course of a day, sometimes during the course of a minute. how easily our states of mind change. And that does have a great deal of validity to it, you know, that kind of pattern holds water. And it's also very much the case within the Christian world. Also, quite coincidentally, this week I spent 3 or 4 days at a seminar in London, which was His Holiness the Dalai Lama giving commentaries on the Christian Gospels, which is a pretty unique event. And it was an amazing thing. So if I look a bit sort of bleary-eyed, it's because I've been sort of talking and meeting with people non-stop from 7 in the morning till 11 at night all week long. But it was interesting how these questions did come up, these same areas of heaven and hell, the ascension, interesting subject, the whole realm of metaphysics and how Tibetan Buddhism sees it and how Christianity sees it. And when they got onto this subject, and the Dalai Lama was at this point having a sort of an on-stage discussion with Father Lawrence Freeman, who's both a Catholic priest and a monk. And here the Dalai Lama was talking about this, and he turned to Father Lawrence, who wasn't expecting this, by the way, said, "And heaven, what do you think about heaven? What do Christians believe in about heaven? And, do they think it has some kind of physical existence?" And Father Lawrence said, heaven is sharing in the being of God. And so His Holiness said, "Well, so you mean that you have no concept of any kind of physical, it has no physical quality whatsoever?" And he said, "No. Those descriptions are just stories." What the Pope might think about such a statement, I'm not sure. But anyway, he was fairly categorical. And so he said, "Well, what would you say about hell?" And he said, "Hell is not sharing in the being of God." So His Holiness kind of, right, okay, fair enough, took it in. And so that, you know, very much reflects the current of feeling at this time, and that these are like the Father Lawrence is in a way, you know, even though he might be not absolutely dead center of the, you know, the Vatican's party line, the Christian party line, certainly as a priest and as a monk, as a voice for the Catholic Church, he's reflecting the outlook of a large number of people. Now, also, particularly when it comes to the subject of rebirth, which is of, you know, very much interest and concern to people in the West, you find coming in contact with Buddhism in the main, and also, you know, you have the Dalai Lama sitting up there. He's the 14th Dalai Lama, you know, and it's not because of his parentage. You know, he's sort of officially the 14th incarnation of this being, this person. And so when you're around Buddhists, the subject comes up. And so you tend to find a certain polarity between people who say, "Oh, yeah, of course, it always made a lot of sense to me, the idea that we have past lives and future lives. It makes perfect sense." And other people who say, "Well, of course, that's just symbolic." And when the Buddha was talking about rebirth, what he really meant was rebirth from one state to another. And that when we talk about enlightenment or liberation from rebirth, that's not talking about anything to do with what happens, nothing to do with past lives and future lives. Enlightenment and liberation is to do with the ability that we have as human beings here and now, out of the quality of wisdom and awareness, to stop identifying with what we're not, to let go of our habits of identification with the body, with feelings, perceptions, ideas. And this is what rebirth really means. And actually, I was when I was at this seminar during the week, I was up on stage with some of the people for a little bit, and there was some questions people had put to the Dalai Lama, and one of them was, "What is reborn?" And so he turned to me and says, "Oh, you can answer this one." So this is to room of 350. people, mostly Christians, but mostly Christian meditators. It was a meditation group that had convened the seminar. So I described it in the best way that I could, saying it was basically, it's our habits that are reborn. And I left it, undefined as to whether we thought really in terms, or whether Buddhists all believe in terms of there being past lives and future lives. I was sorely tempted to use a phrase that came to mind when I was with the Dalai Lama a couple of years ago. I told him, well, we were discussing, actually, he asked me what I thought about birth control. He said, do you think birth control is a good thing? And I said, I'm doing my bit. And then I suddenly remembered something that a monk in Thailand had said to me and said, actually, Buddhists practice rebirth control. That's our main meditation, is rebirth control. Which I thought was quite a neat way of putting it. So I restrained myself from putting that out in front of the conference. But that sense of wanting to encapsulate that process within just ordinary, tangible, psychological events that we can perceive during our day is very strong. And someone like Ajahn Buddhadasa, who I mentioned before, is very, very keen on this and saying this is only what the Buddha was talking about when he teaches dependent origination. When he talks about birth, he doesn't mean rebirth, he means birth, and that means psychological birth into different states of mind, different attitudes and feelings, moods. But we come across a few problems here, one of which... is that there is rather a lot in the scriptures which actually refers to different realms, angelic beings, rebirth, in very tangible physical terms. Like, for example, in the main sutta on conditionality, the Mahanidana Sutta in the Digha Nikaya, when it talks about... this process, it very definitely says when consciousness enters the mother's womb. Morris Fulcher's translation kind of puts it very clearly, and in all of the translations, it makes it very distinct. This is not talking about a psychological analogy. This is talking about living human beings. And you get over and over and over again throughout the scriptures, you get the Buddha making references to the different realms, like in the Mahasayanada Sutta, the Buddha says something like, I understand hell, I understand the path and the way leading to hell, and how on the breaking up of the body after death, a person is born in the hell realms. I understand the ghost realm, I understand the animal realm, I understand the heavenly realm. And over and over and over again in different places, you get this reiterated. You get him saying, using the expression, I recall my manifold past life, and describes, at such and such a time I was this, I was that. There's places where he says, I was a great Brahma god, or I was Saka, king of the heaven of the 33 gods, 36 times. I was Saka, king of the gods. I was a universal monarch many hundreds of times. So these are fairly clear, unequivocal statements. You can say, well, it's all later interpolation, and he didn't really mean it. But, it starts to wear a bit thin because there's, and I'm not particularly credulous on this stuff, but there's page after page after page of it all the way through. It's referred to, and it's a very much of a sort of matter of fact expression, and in many different ways, many different forms. So then we're stuck with the question: well, who's right and who's wrong? If this is the word of the Buddha, if we can say, well, at least some of the scriptures must be actually what the Buddha said, And he's speaking very categorically in terms of there being heavens and hells and past lives and future lives. Where does that leave us? What does that bring us to? Now, the way that I myself have often approached this, and particularly when people ask questions, is that I try and make that clear that, yes, the Buddha laid this stuff out very clearly and spoke about the existence of different realms and past lives, future lives, in a very categorical way. But all of that is in the framework of his approach towards the nature of belief and knowledge. And for me, that's the more important thing. So that all of the sort of metaphysical teachings are laid out. It's all fairly clearly described. But the fact is that that's not a central teaching. The centrality of that knowledge or that way of looking at things or those facts. Is very small. They're not the focus of our attention. So whereas in a teaching like Christianity, over the centuries, the metaphysical aspects of it, like the virgin birth or the ascension into heaven or the nature of God the Father and so on, those are very much central aspects of the Christian teaching. The central mysteries, that's what it's focused on. In the Buddhist tradition, the metaphysical things are spoken of, and I think it's important to recognize, he did actually talk in this way, but the fact is that's not at the center, it's more peripheral. So when approaching the whole nature of belief and knowledge, then the most obvious reference is the Kalama Sutta, where the Buddha is approached and asked by people, how do we know what to believe? This guru comes through here and he says such and such is true, and that sounds reasonable. And then someone else comes through town and they say the opposite. And then another one comes through, and then another, and then another. And each one has their own philosophy. Each one, sounds convincing or impressive to a degree. And we don't know how to trust, a person, or how do we find out what's true and valuable? So then the Buddha says to them, he gives a whole list of injunctions that he gives to the people, the Kalama people, and says, you are right in doubting. You doubt that which should be doubted. So you're not at fault for being in a state of doubt, because you don't know. So the most important thing is to listen to what is said, take it in and see what of that leads to harmony, leads to benefit, leads to happiness for yourself and others. And whatever does that, then take it and follow it. Whatever leads to disharmony, to pain or confusion within yourself or others, then leave that aside. So that it's a very much an experiential mode. One is the method of approach is experiential. What works is the important thing. Now, another sutta that I often quote, particularly on these questions of, do Buddhists believe in rebirth, or do you believe in other realms of existence? And I think probably the most important sutta, and one that doesn't get a lot of attention, is in the Majjhima Nikaya, which is called the Apanike Sutta, which is the 60th. Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. And this I came across years ago, and I thought it was an amazingly neat way of approaching the whole question. Because what the Buddha says in this sutta is, again, he's very, very categorical about the existence of other states of existence. He says, there is the other world, and those who say that there is not, or those who think that there is no other world, or there are no other states of existence other than this, they hold this is wrong view. And those who have the intention, there is no other world, they have a wrong intention. And those who say there is no other world, there is no other states of existence, that is wrong speech. So he really lays it on the line. It's not just one paragraph, he does it over and over again. I have it down here if you want to hear it. And it does it over and over again with different aspects of a view. And so he lays it right on the line. This is it's wrong view to think that there is not other states of existence other than this world that is visible to our eyes. So it's very much a metaphysical statement. But then, having laid that out very categorically, and it's a very long sutta, and he goes over and over and over the subject. In the same time, he says, well, someone who then holds the view there is no other world, there are no other states of existence other than this. Well, let them hold that view. Let those people hold that view, and they are welcome to that view. And then what he does is he points out that the fact is that we as individuals might not know that to be true. Even though, say that holding that view opposes what enlightened beings know to be true. You know, he's very emphatic about it. He said, to say there is no other world, there are no other states of existence, opposes what is known by arahants. So he's really presses the point. But then there's this extraordinary way he has of approaching it, which is a kind of double indemnity, where he says, now, even if the people who oppose that view are correct, even if there is no other world, what you get is that if someone doesn't believe in the fruit in this world and other worlds, if they live in a good way, if they are kind, unselfish, if they live in a wholesome way, if they develop what is profitable, then people in this life will praise them, and they will not be criticized by the wise. They will be noble and good people. And if there is no other world, then they will have not wasted their time here and now. If it turns out that there is another world, and they live in a way which is selfish or unprofitable, unskillful, unwholesome, and that there is no other world, certainly that way of behavior, of behaving in a selfish and unwholesome way, will take them to a state of deprivation. A state of pain, take them to the hell realms. So that what that means is, if you live in a good way, if you live a wholesome life, if there is no other world, then you've done all right now. And if there is another world, then you get to be reborn in a pleasant place, because certainly your goodness of your actions, your wholesomeness of your actions, will enable you to be reborn in a heavenly world. So he says, that one has a lucky throw on both counts, is the phrase he uses. Has a lucky throw on both counts. And then the other character, who lives an unwholesome life, who is selfish and unkind, who lives in an unprofitable way, if there is another world, then certainly those actions will take them to a painful place. And so they have an unlucky throw on both counts. So that what he's saying is that the belief system is not important, but the whole thing hinges around the fact that the way we live is the crucial thing. I don't know if I've explained that very well, but if that makes sense. But the crucial point is that not the metaphysical map that we create for ourselves, but that if we live in a wholesome and good way, if we are unselfish, if we're kind and we're generous, then that's going to benefit ourselves. It's going to benefit everyone. And the opposite is true, if we live in a selfish and unkind way. So that even though he states in the same sutta very, very categorically, you know, there is this metaphysical structure, and at the same time he says, but that's not the important thing. And so, it's a sutta I'd encourage people to look out, because it talks about this area in a very thorough and clear way, and gives a very good model for how to approach it within our own lives. Now, having said that, then we're still left with a few questions, of course. Because we might say, yeah, but, you know, he says that's true, but, you know, I don't really believe it. And I can get, I can understand that, you know, yes, it's worthwhile being a good person and being kind and generous, and yeah, that makes sense. And I know if I act in that way, I feel good now, and so on. But, you know, what really is going on? You know, how do we get to know what is beyond the world of our senses, or what is the reality? And I forget whether I quoted this last week, but I was very struck by it, so I'll quote it again anyway. Which is an exchange which took place at the World Congress of Faiths, the World Parliament of Religions centenary, this was a man was asking a Tibetan Lama. This man was a practitioner of Tibetan Buddhism. And he'd been doing all these different kind of devotional pujas and practices for years. And he was having these doubts. He had Tara, who's a sort of an emanation of Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva of compassion. Tara is this feminine bodhisattva. And this guy had been doing all these pujas and devotional practices to Tara for years and years. And he was being stricken by these doubts about whether Tara was really there or not. And so he decided, okay, well, I'm going to ask the Lama. So finally, he bolstered up his courage and said to the Lama, well, you know, I really have to get a straight answer on this. I really have to know, once and for all, you know, from the bottom of your heart, I need you to tell me, you know, does Tara really exist or does she not? You know, I don't want any kind of special teachings, you know, just tell me, you know, yes or no. Just give me a straight answer. And so the Lama thought about it for a while, and kind of paused, and the clock ticked by, and finally the Lama went, aha, and he figured out how to express it, and he said, she knows that she's not real. Which I thought was the most brilliant way of expressing it. But it still leaves us with a certain degree of frustration. Now, even though the Buddha did make these very categorical metaphysical statements, there was a lot of things that he left unspoken, what they called the undeclared propositions, if you like. And that numerous times during the suttas, you find numerous times where people approach the Buddha with this, what seems to be a standard list of 10 questions, which the Buddha always refused to answer. And these were things like, is the universe eternal? Is it not eternal? Is the universe finite or is it infinite? Are the soul, is the Atman and the body one thing, or is the Atman and the body two things? Does an enlightened being, a Tathagata, do they exist after death? Do they not exist after death? Do they both exist and not exist after death? And do they neither exist nor not exist after death? So basically, you know, this whole string of metaphysical questions. And on those, the Buddha refused to answer. Like when a wanderer called Vachagota approaches him, and he says, I said, what's the Buddha's view on these 10 questions? The Buddha just says that, you know, the Tathagata does not have a view about this. And he goes through each one, and the Buddha gives the same reply. Or when Uttiya asks the Buddha the same questions, he says, these questions are not answered by the Tathagata. He says, I just don't answer them. And other times when he just remains silent, doesn't answer at all. And and in a way, it reflects very much, I think, my own experience and many people, like, you know, wanting to know, wanting to understand, you know, what is really true on these kind of areas. And you get this great, there's a lovely exchange between the Buddha and one of his monks called Malunkyaputta, where he comes to the Buddha and he's really in a state, and he says, okay, I'm going to get this out, same as the guy at the Parliament of Religions. He goes to the Buddha and he threatens to disrobe if the Buddha won't answer him the questions. He says, you've got to answer these questions, otherwise I'm going to disrobe and I'm going to cease being your disciple. And the Buddha says, well, you know, did I promise if you became a monk that I would give you the answers to these questions? And he says, well, no. But anyway, this is where the Buddha gives the analogy, of the soldier wounded on the battlefield with a poisoned arrow. And the surgeon comes up to the soldier on the battlefield and says to him, that, you know, I'm going to pull the arrow out to save you. And the man lies there and says, no, I'm not going to let you pull the arrow out until you find out, you know, who it was who shot me. What clan did they? Were they a Kshatriya? Were they a Vaishya? Were they an artisan? Were they tall, short? Were they dark or fair? Did they come from a village or a town or a city? What kind of wood was is the arrow made from? You know, what kind of sinews did the sinew made to wrap the arrowhead come in? What shape is the arrowhead? What bird did the feathers for the arrow come from? And it has this marvelously absurd list of demands that the guy gives to the Buddha. And the Buddha says, of course, you know, the man's going to die before the surgeon can have a chance to answer all the questions. And so he says, exactly the same way, Mulunkya, that the reason why I don't answer these questions is because they don't lead to peace, to dispassion, to enlightenment, to nibbana. And that's why I don't speak of them. And that what I do speak of is that there is suffering, there is the origin of suffering, there is the cessation of suffering, and there's the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And this I teach, this I talk about, because this leads to dispassion, leads to peace, to enlightenment, to nibbana. And you find within the Mahayana school, Mahayana Buddhism, that they actually, a lot of these questions get answered by them. This is in the Theravadan scriptures, the Buddha is absolutely resolute, doesn't budge an inch on these questions. In Mahayana scriptures, say like in the Lotus Sutra, you get quite clear descriptions of the answers to some of these questions, and particularly the nature of the Buddha. Post-mortem nature of the Buddha, what happens to a Tathagata after the death of the body. And also I noticed at this conference in London that the Dalai Lama was quite freely, kind of openly talking about, you know, what the state of a Buddha after the death of the body. I couldn't remember all of what he said, but it was all fairly, you know, worked out and described. But to me, I've always found it a very important and crucial aspect of the teaching that the Buddha did not speak of that. That, you know, there are some metaphysical statements that he makes, but I also think that as a reflection for us, as a way of guiding us towards true understanding or useful understanding, real understanding, the fact that he won't speak of that which is beyond the realm of our senses in this respect is very important. It's giving us a message that, okay, there's maybe a purpose to have a cosmological map, but this has only got a relative importance. And the purpose of spiritual knowledge, of spiritual training, is not to try and have a cartography of the entire universe, to have everything sort of lined up and categorized. That's not the point. And that the emphasis is on this very quality of the knowledge which leads to liberation, freedom of heart of the individual. And also the fact that the true knowledge or the true reality is not definable within terms of concept, within terms of thought or word. And this is something that's said over and over again. It's a kind of truism of, you know, ultimate reality is beyond words and language, and sort of we don't even really think about what that means or how important that is. But in pondering this area of metaphysics and heaven and hell and so on, and these kind of questions that are put or that arise in our minds, what it says to me, or when the Buddha refuses to speak, it's saying to us, are we asking the right kind of questions? What are we presuming about our life and the nature of the world in the way that we ask a question? And this is in the exchange that the Buddha has with Vajragota, when he's been thoroughly frustrated with his ten questions. And he's really confused. And he says to the Buddha, I'm really confused. You know, why, you know, you don't answer these questions. Well, what actually is the truth? And the Buddha says, well, if I had, you know, you ask the questions about, you know, the nature of a Tathagata after death. And so, say for example, we had a fire burning here in front of us, made of grass and sticks. Now, if we let that fire go out, the fire goes out, then I ask you, where did the fire go? Did it go north, south, east, or west? What would you say? And then Vajragota says, well, the question doesn't apply. It didn't go north, south, east, or west. It just went out. And the Buddha says, in exactly the same way, the questions that you ask presume a reality that does not exist. So when you say, where does a Tathagata go after death? There is no answer to that question, because the question presumes a reality that does not exist. You're creating a conceptual framework that doesn't match the reality. When the Buddha is questioned on this a few times, and this comes up many times, and then he's always pointing to this, the Tathagata, or the nature of the enlightened being, or the enlightened mind, cannot be defined in terms of the body, of perceptions, of thoughts, or feelings, what we call the five khandhas, the five aspects of body and mind, the nature of the enlightened mind or the enlightened being cannot be defined in those terms, that they are described outside of that. And so that in that way of refusing to allow that quality of enlightenment, or the enlightened being, the true reality of things, to be established in terms of word or thought or concept, you know, the Buddha is pushing us to, I say, a different kind of knowledge. Because all of those other approaches towards understanding what is beyond our sense of perception, both the sort of the psychological interpretation, or the interpretation of heaven and hell, or even just the one I was talking about with the double indemnity approach, where even there you're just acting or developing an approach to life that depends on what is perceivable by our eyes and ears, by our what is empirically verifiable by what we can see and feel and taste and touch. So what he's pointing to instead is a kind of knowing which is not knowing about, but a direct and non-conceptual seeing, knowing, looking into the nature of experience itself. Now this is the kind of metaphysics, if you like, this is the area that is really where it's crucial, say, for us to get an understanding. And it's not a matter of a belief, this kind of direct knowing that the Buddha is pointing to, the middle way, which is say, establishing an understanding, a seeing into life in that very, say, immediate way. Because our normal way of relating to life is always to categorize it into a thought, into an idea, into a conceptual picture. And that what the Buddha is talking about, like realizing the middle way, keeping to the middle way, is like withdrawing our urge to go into belief or into conceptualization or to naming our reality, to say encapsulating it, but instead to withhold that tendency to go out into believing, into creating a concept, and instead to stay with that quality of direct knowing. Like there's a beautiful passage where he's just after the Enlightenment, where the Buddha's describing, he's surveying the world with his all-seeing eye, and seeing how, you know, deluded all of us lot are, and how caught up and confused living beings are in the world of pleasure and pain. And then he uses this phrase when he's describing the enlightened state of one who sees, one who knows, abandons craving for being without relishing non-being. So it's like letting go of that which exists without, say, the mind craving for non-existence, or the mind moving to non-existence. Now that is a very difficult quality. Conceive. Extremely difficult to conceive. To abandon craving for being without relishing non-being. So it's in a way letting go of our identification with the whole phenomenal world, and to allow the mind to rest in that quality of pure knowing. And this is what the Buddha was trying to direct towards. This is the kind it's an empirical knowledge. It's an empirical knowing, it's known directly by the individual, but it's not knowing about, it's not a conceptual knowing, it's not dependent on sight or sound or feeling. It's a knowing directly from the heart. Now, this is interesting also, as I was looking into this, that the Buddha referred to this kind of realization as coming to the end of the world, which fits in very well with eschatology and the judgment day. I thought I'd read one of these bits of these books here that this is a very well-known passage, which comes from, it's in the Sanyutta Nikaya, and it says, "The Blessed One was once living at Savati in Jeta's grove. A deity called Rohitasa came to him late in the night, paid homage to him and asked, 'Lord, the world's end, where one neither is born, nor ages, nor dies, nor passes away, nor reappears, is it possible to know or see or reach that by traveling there?' 'Friend, that there is a world's end where one neither is born, nor ages, nor dies, nor passes away, nor reappears, which is to be known or seen or reached by traveling there, that I do not say. Yet I do not say that there is an ending of suffering without reaching the world's end. Rather, it is in this fathom-long body, with its perceptions and its mind, that I describe the world, the origin of the world, the cessation of the world, and the way leading to the cessation of the world. 'Tis utterly impossible to reach by walking the world's end, but none escape from suffering until the world's end has been reached. It is a sage, a knower of the world, who gets to the world's end, and it is they by whom the holy life has been lived out. In knowing the world's end, they are at peace, and they hope for neither this world nor the next.' So that's reflecting that sense of if we're looking for an understanding of what is beyond the world of senses, rather than trying to conceive the belief system that works, what the Buddha's pointing to is a transcendence of the whole thing, because all those other approaches are worldly in their own nature, whether it's in terms of a cosmology, of a psychological approach, of just using our own sense experience. All of those are trying to solve the problem on a worldly level. And if we are examining that presumption and we let that go, then we enter into solving the question through the quality of transcendence itself. And this is exactly what the Buddha is talking about. You can't get to the end of the question by thinking about it. So what he's doing is like getting to the bottom of the question. The source of the question is here within this body, within this mind. So this is what he means, within this fathom-long body with its perceptions and its mind. This is the origin of the world and the cessation of the world and the way leading to the cessation of the world. I also came, years ago, I came across this great phrase. It was in a series of plays called The Illuminati by this slightly inspired nutcase called Robert Anton Wilson. And he talked about the central event of these plays. I won't go into it. An enormous epic, but what he called the immanentization of the eschaton. The eschaton is like the final day, the final moment, and making that making that imminent, bringing that here, and it struck me. I don't know why I remember these things, but it sprang out of my memory. I said, "Oh, that's exactly the same thing that this man was talking about." That the Buddha is talking about the finality or the ending of the world happens here. And when the mind is awake, where one who knows the world comes to the end of the world. Now, also our culture tends to think has a very positivist way of expressing itself, so that truth or fulfillment or goodness is generally expressed in sort of overt terms. It's talked about in terms of having or becoming. When we come across the Buddhist, these kind of particularly Theravadan Buddhist expressions of the nature of fulfillment as being the end of the world, there's a slight dissonance. There, it's like, wait a minute, I kind of like the world. You know, the end of the world is what the ecologists are terrified of, and the idea of the end of the world as being a good thing, it just doesn't quite fit with our perceptions. And so here you have the Buddha waxing lyrically about how marvelous the end of the world, that you can think, oh, well, I don't really like the idea of that. But it's also interesting the simile that the Buddha used when he was talking with Vajragotha about fire. When a fire goes out, where does it go? And with the word nibbana itself means cooling down, or like a flame being blown out, the going out of a flame. And normally, in our Western way of thinking, that seems like something has died, it's gone, it's dead. When it's alive, it's on fire, it expresses, it's seen, it's visible, it's active. And when it's ended, when it's out, when the fire is gone, then that's death. But there was a friend of mine, an American Buddhist monk called Tanisaro, pointed out to me a year or two ago when I was talking with him. This came up in conversation. He's actually just written a book on the subject of the. There's a great misunderstanding of the symbolism of fire as it's used within Theravada literature, and because within the Vedic understanding, and also which would have been the common understanding at the time of the Buddha, that a fire when it's ablaze, when there are flames. This is seen as a state of agitation. The flame exists in a state of clinging, dependent on the fuel. So that, say, the universe is composed of the fire element. And when it, loses control, or when it's in a when the fire element or the energy of the universe is in a degenerate state, then an object catches fire. So when there are flames, when the thing is on fire, then that's a diminished state of clinging, attachment. Limitation. And that when a fire goes out, rather than that meaning death, what that means is that the energy of the universe, the fire element, then returns to its primordial, omnipresent state. So when a fire goes out, rather than it that meaning meaning death, it's exactly the same as the universal energy no longer just sort of spewing itself out and burning and kind of wasting itself in a chaotic or needless way, but it's in a state of stillness, of quietude, of balance. It returns to its primordial, omnipresent state, is the phrase used in the Vedas or Upanishads. And that struck me as turning the whole analogy around very, very. Effectively and completely, because what it means is that with the idea of the ending of the world, or the flame going out, the fire being extinguished, it's not a symbol of loss, or of death, or of something which is threatening, but it's rather more like the state of being on fire is like when the mind is just agitated and active. And this is what we call the mind in with the asavas, the outflows sort of blazing. We're agitated, excited, or worried about something. The mind is flowing out. It's in a state of flame. It's inflamed. And then when the energy of the mind withdraws, when there's mindfulness, clarity, composure, then rather than being in that isolated and agitated state of clinging, instead the mind is in an open, universal, peaceful, serene quality. The mind has returned to its primordial state. This is like the fire returning to its primordial condition. So when we talk about the ending of the world, or the blowing out of a flame, then the analogy that's being used is as with fire. So that it's not something which is being lost, something which we valued, which is now absent, and we're just having to be at peace with with the space that it's left behind. That's not it at all. When we talk about the ending of the world, or the eschaton, the last moment, finality, that's not a kind of cosmic death, but actually an awakening to the timeless reality, to the final point I thought I'd make is that often we talk about we use this kind of negative terminology. The expression is very negative in the way of speaking, but along with the quality of emptiness, like of the different qualities of the phenomenal world. We have there's a quality of sunyata, which means emptiness or nothingness. Its partner is the quality of tatata, or suchness, like the word tathagata means thus gone or thus come. Tatata means thusness or suchness. And so that reflects a quality of immanence, of presence. And so that when we are talking about the use of this kind of mind, which lets go of identification, which the mind of the which is attuned to the middle way, which is not grasping or rejecting anything, then that that points us to the quality of realization, which is not just an absence of things, but is the also the quality of suchness, of a quality of fullness. And these two do not exclude each other. So that when we're talking about the Buddha's approach to the realization of that which is beyond the sense world, this is a very clear and tangible experience that is aimed at, and it's the experience of wholeness, of fullness, of suchness. Also, it struck me that whenever a Dhamma, traditionally speaking, whenever a Dhamma talk is given, the final word is Ewang. That signals the fact that the talk is finished. And Ewang just means thus. Thus it is. That's the final word. And that in terms of eschatology, the final word is thus. And so in a way I thought, well, that's a very beautiful way of speaking about it. If the Buddha talks in terms of the end of the world, the end of the talk, you know, when something comes to a completion, there's the way one that is reflected is to say, thus it is, that that things end, the ending of the world, the Nirodha, Nibbana, the cessation of things, they end in suchness. And that is the aim of all these ideas, all this knowledge, these principles, are aiming us at the realization of that quality. So, I will say Ewang at this point, and I'm sure there'll be a few questions in a little while, and so we can break up for a quarter of an hour or so. And it's about 5 past now, so if we get back together about in about 20 minutes, 25 past.
Thank you very much.
Do you want to turn off the fans? So, does anyone have any anything they'd like to ask about, or any questions or reflections they might have? Yes.
You mentioned somebody called Tara. Who would that be?
In Tibetan Buddhism, Tara is a within Tibetan and Mahayana Buddhism, they have a whole number of beings that are called bodhisattvas, which are, if you like, highly evolved beings who have some kind of metaphysical existence, who are dedicated to in full enlightenment, to Buddhahood, and they exist very much in the same way as you have in other religions, as the embodiment of certain qualities. So you have, say, Manjushri, who is the embodiment of wisdom, and Avalokiteshvara, who is the embodiment of compassion. And then Tara is a kind of offshoot from Avalokiteshvara. So she's, a representative of compassion, and is treated very much in the same way that within Christianity they would treat their sort of pantheon of Jesus and Mary and the saints and so on, so that they are people would relate to Tara and to Manjushri and others in a sort of part of their devotional practices. Yes.
How many different schools of Buddhism are there?
An awful lot. Each different Buddhist country has usually got quite a variety of different approaches. Right from the very beginning, there was always a wide range of different approaches towards the Buddha's teaching. So, generally speaking, they're broadly divided up according to country, because within each country there's a particular style has developed of Buddhist practice. So, I'd say loosely speaking, there's about 8 or 10 major different schools that represent the different Buddhist countries and different styles of practice. But within those, there's dozens and dozens of others. Yes.
There are a number of different philosophies and traditions in the world that make a distinction between humans and animals. It seems to me sometimes that distinction is arbitrary. But it's usually along the lines of humans that are superior. We talk about the
Well, I wouldn't say versus. Within the Buddhist cosmology, the animal realm, and also as you can experience, the animal realm is characterized by being driven by instinct, so that there's not a lot of leeway within the animal realm for the development of wisdom or unselfishness, or the higher spiritual qualities, and so the it's seen that the level of consciousness is quite coarse, and it's quite a brutal, painful realm to be born in. Life is usually ends by being eaten by somebody else, and usually before you're dead. And so that within the Buddhist cosmology, it's seen that the animal being born as an animal is an unfortunate kind of birth, or a lower kind of birth. But not as a value judgment, just saying that's how it is. It's there's limited faculties that you have as an animal in terms of what you can do with the with the life that you have. And the human world is always talked about as being the world which is most favourable for enlightenment, because it has the kind of the painful and difficult aspects of life of the animal world, but mixed in sort of equal measures, or roughly equal measures, with the clarity of mind and the pleasure of the heavenly worlds. So that because of that mixture of pleasure and pain, of high-mindedness and brutality, then one has an overview of the whole variety of different possible forms of existence, if you like, and therefore, because of having that overview and participating in pain and pleasure, experiencing that, then that acts as the most effective environment for developing understanding, because like the heavenly world is characterized by being totally pleasant, almost the different heavens vary in degrees of pleasantness, but they're all very, very nice. And so that the way it's talked about is that because there's so much pleasure and sensual delight, that the mind is not, even though the mind might be very powerful or clear, it's not really in a contemplative mode. You're just enjoying yourself too much. You're not really trying to understand the nature of existence, because you're not pushed into that by needing to resolve the problem of experiencing pain or struggle. So there's no condemnation of the animal world, and also the teachings on karma and rebirth are very effective in making one quite, sensitive towards the animal world, and the fact that this might be you, or at least you're recognizing that you too have been an animal in many lives, or that you would, if you were in that position, would you like to be treated in that way? And because you just having that as a conceptual framework makes one far more sensitive or compassionate towards the animal world than if you're thinking of it as something completely other. Like I think a lot of people within the Christian world recognize it's been quite a drawback to think of the animal world placed upon the earth for the use of humanity. These have been put there for you to use has led to a very cruel and heavy-handed appreciation of the animal world. Say, like within the Buddhist tradition, you have the Jataka stories with the Buddha being born as a parrot or as a deer or as a monkey or whatever. And so that then that even in an unconscious way creates a powerful model for the way in which one is going to relate to the animal world. I mean, not to say that people in Buddhist countries don't treat animals badly, but that sensitivity is there. That kind of consciousness is there. Yes. I would say that it's there, but it's much less so. It's much more covered over by the instinctual qualities. But particularly animals which are associated with human beings, then they and the higher kinds of animals. I mean, there are animals associated with human beings have that kind of quality. Humans associate with them because they have that kind of quality. Do you understand what I mean? So like cats and dogs or horses, animals which can learn and which can live in concord with other creatures. I mean, but like say, for example, an animal will show compassion for its own kind. You know, it can give up its a mother animal can give up her own life for her offspring. But you would never find an animal that would give up its life for an animal of a different species. At least extremely rarely. But a human being could imagine, you know, can do that. Not that it happens that often, those qualities are there because it's, you know, in a way that it's still just the mind being located in different realms of existence. But it's like the density of instinct which is there can be very, very thick sort of veil to see through. So for example, a cat can look incredibly peaceful. I mean, the cats around here are amazingly relaxed creatures. There's the white and ginger one that just, it never does anything except just lounge around and different kinds of coma. You know, you pick it up, it's like a boneless, you know, a boneless lump. But also, you know, even a cat like that, as soon as it's walking outside, if it hears a rustle in the grass, and you know it's a hunter within half a second, and it will attack a mouse and play with it and so on, and so that, you know, even though you think, wow, it's a really peaceful life being a cat, that's the kind of samadhi I could. The kind of samadhi, kind of relaxation I could do with. It's a quietude, if you like, but it's not coming. It's not necessarily associated with a quality of wisdom. So I'd say those qualities are there, but for animals, they're much, much more reduced. Well, just the ability that we have to override instinct for wisdom and unselfishness, compassion, to override instinct. That's all, really. Apart from that, there's no difference. And of course, you know, the how evolved the animal is. I mean, it's going to be very different between, say, a dog and a flea or a a gnat. You know, they don't have very highly developed mental faculties as far as one could tell. So, you know, there's a great variation within what we call the animal world, I'm sure. Yes. No, I don't think human beings are unique at all. It's my feeling, is that there are particular qualities of being born as a human that make this life the best environment for developing an understanding of life. But I don't think it's sort of intrinsically unique, like in a way that you get within, say, Christianity, Christian teachings, or Judaism or Islam, where, you know, humans are a unique creation and the rest is all something else. It's very much, I think, you know, a part of a continuum, and we all have the instincts and attributes of the animal world. You know, it's like just on a biological level. If you look at what a human embryo is like, it is various during the months of its evolution, as it grows up within the mother's womb. Then, you know, we resemble fishes and we even have gills at a certain point in the growth of the embryo, just like a fish, and have a tail, and so on. So you can actually see the sort of evolutionary cycle happening just right there within the growth of just a single child. So that you know, that's our ancestry, and we still participate in those worlds. The instinctual world is there, but we just, as a human being, we have the ability to go beyond that. Yeah, I wouldn't agree with that point of view. Yes.
Excuse me, you know, talking about the Christian doctrine, there's a kind of common ground, because when you think about it, with Christ on the cross, that's a symbol of suffering, and suffering, in a sense, is this sort of starting point of Buddhism.
Yes, very similar. I mean, it's the transcendence of suffering is very much what both that is symbolized in the crucifixion, and also is the starting point of spiritual life for the Buddhist. It's like the recognition of and acceptance of that, the apprehension of suffering. If you're wallowing in it or complaining about it or glorifying it, then you're missing the point. But it's that acknowledgement of it, but also the in that acknowledgement there's a transcendence of it, and so that that, I mean, there are a lot of parallels. I mean, this last week, being at this conference, it was interesting to see how many parallels there were. I mean, there were metaphysical differences, obviously, like the way that is described, or what is held to be true. But it was, you know, it was interesting that it was all the things that were actually sort of out of sight that where the disagreements were. Like, you know, the uniqueness of Jesus, or the existence of a soul. It's like, well, those are out of sight, if you like. They're metaphysical. We can't actually see them, or you can't say, well, yes, this is purple, you know, or this is metal. They're not there for our senses to pick up on, and so it was the Dalai Lama's approach was very interesting insofar as he said that. From the very beginning, you know, he didn't want to be putting doubts into people's minds. And also that he felt that it was good to point out where there are parallels, but also it's good to be very clear where there are divergences, where Buddhism and Christianity don't think the same. He said it would be a terrible mistake to think that we have to just fudge it all together and make it all the same thing. So I think it's quite... Well, they wouldn't speak of it in terms of it being like a sort of discrete bubble of being. Like it was particularly what the Buddha was pointing at, because that was very much the belief of the Vedic, the Hindu tradition, was that the Atman goes from one body to another, and then eventually experiences release. But the Buddha was saying, well, that's not an accurate representation of it. That's not really how it is. What you can say is that there's rather than there is a sort of a distinct individual consciousness that goes from one life, one birth to another. There's like one birth conditions the next. So it affects the next, so like the momentum of one life. It's rather like if you, if I see if I can do this. See, like this this spoon is still, this one is, if this was, this one moves, then when this one stops, that one moves. So it's like when this life comes to an end, this one starts. So the energy that was in this spoon, then it gets transferred to that spoon. It's not, it's the same, but it's different. It's like, are you the same person that you were when you were 3 years old? Well, yes and no. You know, your body's completely different. But there's something about what you were when you were three that is the same, and some aspects which are very, very different. So that what is said is there's a conditionality, like an effect that carries on, a momentum of karma, if you like, that carries on, and it will condition the mind being born in a different place, but to represent that as it's like an individual soul that's sort of complete unto itself, going from one place to another, the Buddha was very adamant about. He said it's more like a flame being passed from one candle to another. That yes, you can say it's the same flame, but it's not quite the same. It's not exactly the same thing. Well, what? Yeah, that's true, but what you can say is that there is the experience of the results of good and bad action, but to say that what experience is that is an individual being, an individual entity, is not the truth of the reality, is not the truth of the situation. It's you know, it looks very much like that, or it can look very much like that. And so, and you know, you even have the Buddha saying, you know, I had, you know, many past lives. I was, you know, a Brahma god, or I was Sakha 36 times. You know, and so that in common speech, one can talk in that way. But at the deepest level, to talk about, you know, me as an individual experience this is like saying that's not the accurate way of speaking about it. And so you can say there's awareness of the results of wholesome action or unwholesome action. And that is, you know, the mind is aware of that. But to say that, to claim that as me and mine, as a sort of self-existent entity, the Buddha was always saying, no, that's not quite it. And it's very difficult to describe. But if one is looking at it in an experiential way, when you feel something, when there's a say when you've done something good, or when something pleasant happens, what you say is, you feel a warm glow. You act in a kind way. You're helpful towards someone, and you feel good about that. You say, oh, "I feel good because I helped so and so." But then, when you look directly, when there's a direct looking into that experience, you say, "Yes, there's an awareness of that pleasant feeling." But that awareness is that in itself is not, it doesn't have a personal quality to it. Do you see what I mean? It's like there's an awareness of that pleasant feeling, just as if you'd done something cruel and you were feeling kind of guilty or bad about it. There'd be an awareness of a painful feeling, but then to say this is my pain, or this is my happiness, this is me, this is what I am, this is mine, this is myself, is missing the point. And they say, yeah, well, there's a feeling of happiness, there's a feeling of pleasure. But this is not me, this is not what I am, this is not myself, this is a feeling which passes. And that the Buddha is always trying to point to that quality of knowing which is prior to it being named as me or mine, what I am. So that you're going sort of back beyond, you're coming from a place where there is the impersonal quality of knowing and awareness, which is not male or female, not young or old, that has no kind of characteristic of that nature. And then the more that is realized, the more it's recognized that is the quality that exists at the heart of everybody. That awareness is not my awareness, it's more of a universal quality. And that's why the more the mind rests in that quality of awareness and clarity and lets go of personal distinction, then there results a much greater quality of unity with other people, with other beings. There's a quality of unification, of oneness that's there. And so that the feeling of personhood or personal identity will be sustained as long as there is a body and a personality. But that's why when the Buddha wouldn't talk about what happens to an enlightened being when they die, because when you are saying that, well, the idea of being a person can sustain itself as long as there's the karmic conditions which continue to bring that impression about, of being alive, having a body, having thoughts and feelings and perceptions. But when the body dies, if the mind is totally awake, is totally, say, coming from that quality of pure awareness and impersonal awareness, then when the body dies, then that awareness is not located anywhere. Doesn't go anywhere. It's not rooted in identification with anything or any place. So then that's why the Buddha said, when you ask where does an enlightened being go when they die, where does not apply, because it's assuming that that person is a kind of a discrete entity located in this place, in this time, and that they must go from here to some place, some other location. But what he was trying to point to is that we only feel like an individual because of the momentum of attachment within our minds. When that momentum fades out, then there's nothing which is causing us to crystallize as an individual. And then people say, yeah, well, what's that like? And he said, it's not expressible. It's not knowable. He said, the most that you get out of him, at least in the Theravadan scriptures, the most you get is where he says something like, at the breaking up of the body after death, an enlightened one passes beyond the comprehension of gods and humans. That's as much as you get.
I once heard an interesting theory from somebody. Why should I bother about karma? When I die, I'll just be snuffed out, and all this karmic burden will pass on to somebody else. I don't know, it isn't me. It'll be somebody from my misdeeds, I don't care.
Somebody else's problem, yes.